and welcome to the Reformed Party podcast. I've said that line about 60 times in the last year. I started this podcast with the intention of giving a platform where we could discuss anything related to Reform UK. I hope over the year you have enjoyed it. My first victim was the chair of the Wirral branch of Reform, Mr. David Burgess Joyce. Now, in his day job, David was a senior police officer, so it seemed obvious to start by asking him what had gone wrong with policing in the UK over the last 5 to 10 years.
I definitely put it down to the mid-90s. Of course, Blair coming along in 97, he reduced the requirements even more. Mm. And so what's happened over the years is the College of Policing, which was a fairly newish organisation, decided that it would get involved with what's called common purpose, common purposes. And it basically encouraged people to be chief constables. The old days of you staying as a bobby on the beat, where many bobbies were quite happy to stay through their entire career, you were discouraged from doing that. So effectively, you joined the police with a degree in something useless. And as a result, within 2 years, you'd be a sergeant. Mm. And then in another 2 years, you'd be an inspector. And you'd literally spent your career, once you got to chief constable, having been on the streets for about 2 years. And as we now know, particularly in the Metropolitan Police, no one arrests anybody. Mm. No one actually fights crime. And if you look at the College of Policing website at the moment, they have a plan of action, a 5-point plan of action for 2022 to 2026. Not once in that does it mention about fighting crime. That's the College of Policing, which is supposed to set the precedent.
Yeah.
And that's the organisation that brought in non-crime hate incidents, which is one of the most appalling travesties of any... If that happened in Russia, we'd go, oh, well, it's Russia.
Yeah.
But it's happening in Britain. And that is how appalling we have become as a society, because we've allowed liberals to run the roost and effectively destroy this country.
Mm. My next podcast was with Mr. Simon Evans. At the time, Simon was talking about standing as a councillor for Lancashire County Council.
But you've got people, councillors, who've been there for decades, who sit on Lancashire, on West Lancashire District Council, earning £15,000, £16,000, £17,000 a year, and they sit on Lancashire County Council earning £15,000, £16,000. So they're making quite a nice little living there. It's not mega bucks, but I'm sure there's plenty more that goes on top of that. And they are lying. They are lying to the people. They are not interested in what's good for people and what's good for that area. And maybe they started out well-intended, but now they're on this gravy train. And this is where we need to smash through, and we are going to smash through, and we need to change how governance, how justice, how all these things are done. So it's not about making money, it's about doing the right thing. Mm. And that's exactly where reform comes in. It's about...
And Simon was duly elected in the tsunami in May. There were actually 53 councillors elected in Lancashire. He was one of them. Once he started work, I asked him back onto the podcast to see how things were going.
SEND, Special Educational Needs for Children, that is bankrupting every single council in this country, no matter what political colour. So one of the big parts is transporting. We have a legal duty to transport children to school. We can't not do that. We have to do that by law. So what we've done is, rather than pay out for taxis, which are just costing an absolute fortune, I mean, and we're talking about £5 billion a year around the country here, we've invested in 50 minibuses, which is far cheaper, and children can be round-robined around the school rather than paying out taxis. Also, we've sent the backlog of assessments for children was through the ceiling when we arrived here. And we've thrown resource out. We've thrown new AI skills. We've thrown new resources at that. And by February, end of February, that backlog will have gone. Now, that's massive consequences to parents who are waiting for their children to be allocated where they're going to go.
On the same day that Simon was elected, there was another election, this time in Runcorn, a by-election. So I went down to Runcorn to see what was going on.
There we go. Beautiful. Three. I'm Leander Sinn, the Reform UK Member of Parliament for Ashton. I'm here with Sarah today, who's our brilliant candidate in the upcoming election on May the 1st. I'm absolutely staggered by the turnout today, the amount of support we've got locally, people driving, buying cars, wanting leaflets. We've got dozens of volunteers out, and this lady is going to be the fifth Reform UK Member of Parliament on May the 1st.
Thanks, Lee. Yeah, the reception that we're getting is incredible. I feel the energy that people have here in Runcorn and Helsby for change is overwhelming. People want something new. They want someone to fight for the country. They want to get their values back. They want to get community values back. And I think they know that only Reform UK now is the party that can do it. So, 1st of May, vote Reform UK.
So, you must be very excited, aren't you?
I'm so excited. It's an amazing opportunity, not only for me personally, but for the people of Runcorn and Helsby, to get some change, to get someone in that really cares about the community and improve lives.
And what do you think, how do you think you're going to feel that on the day when you step onto that train to take you down to Westminster to the House of Parliament? Is that not going to be exciting?
Well, we obviously don't know what's going to happen yet. I'd love to think that will be the case. And obviously, I really hope that that will be. We're getting a great reception on the doorstep, a great reception in the office. In fact, everywhere we go, to the extent that even people of cars are pulling up when they see us out canvassing on the street to offer their support. So, you know, we could actually do it. And the big thing about, just to finish, the big thing about this area, I think the whole of the country is watching Runcorn and Helsby. And if Reform do it here, then I think it will energise a tsunami of movement across the country to vote Reform.
And on the doorstep, what have you been finding have been the big issues?
Yeah, so some of the biggest issues that we're having to deal with, partly the NHS, because Labour have not got much going for them, quite frankly, in this area. So they are spreading an out-and-out lie about the fact that Reform are going to stop the NHS being free, that they're going to privatise the NHS. And that is absolute rubbish. It's just them making lies up because they are desperate to stop this huge movement that is Reform. But Reform are dedicated to the NHS. We will protect the NHS, and the NHS will remain free at the point of use. So for me, law and order is the absolute bedrock of society. I was a magistrate for 20 years. I really, really understand the problems that people face in their daily lives. Some people are born with a very tough deck of cards, if you like, you need to have an element of compassion. But also we need to be, in my opinion, so much tougher now and crack down on nuisance crime, shoplifting, drugs. You know, it's just not acceptable. I've been canvassing around estates where, you know, you can almost get high on the smell of cannabis. So there just doesn't seem to be that enforcement anymore. We really need to crack down on that, get more police on the streets. So yes, certainly if I was the MP here, more police on the streets, but not only that, tougher policing, absolute must.
When I went down to Runcorn, I also bumped into somebody called Mandy Clare. I found Mandy very interesting. She's a gender-critical feminist and has taken up arms against the transgender movement in Cheshire West and Chester Borough Council.
I mean, you've got under that umbrella trans. I don't think there is such a thing as trans. I think there's a fake umbrella that's been created that a lot of people with a lot of different issues have all been pushed underneath that identity. So you've got young girls who hate their bodies, as your previous guest was talking about. You know, young girls who maybe lesbian, and they haven't quite come to terms with their feelings. They haven't worked all of that out, so they hate themselves because they don't fit into this pop culture of sort of, you know, you get your Botox lips and, you know, you filler in your face and your fake eyelashes and all that. They don't, if they're not girly girls and they can't fit into that trend or they're attracted to other girls, they can end up really hating themselves and wishing that they weren't a girl. You've got kids who've got other sort of mental health problems. Maybe they're being bullied. Maybe they've had some sexual abuse at home and they're alienated from their body and their sexed, you know, self as a result of that. And this ideology has pounced on those kids and told them if they only took some puberty blockers and associated themselves with this cult, they'd have a new family that will be accepting of them and where they can feel comfortable and okay about themselves. So you've got those kids, you've got the boys who are able to access porn a lot more freely online and they get pulled down the sissy porn route. which they wouldn't necessarily have happened to them. You know, I've heard from boys who've come out the other end of that, and they feel as if they've been taken on a pathway that wasn't theirs. And they have luckily emerged from it a few years later without having permanently damaged themselves. But not all of those boys are so lucky. And then you've got older men who are fetishists. There's hardly any older women, middle-aged women, that are suddenly realising that they were men all along. Yeah, yeah. So all of these different diverse groups are put within one category called trans. It's a false identity that's been created. But the more that we use that word and use that language, the more it solidifies it as a reality.
At the Winsford Pride event in 2025, Mandy was arrested. Her court date was set for December of this year. And before the case went to court, all charges were dropped.
Right at the beginning, you're in this situation where you know that the judicial system is being weaponized against people who support reform, for example, you know, the concerns that we share. Yeah. As reform members, we are a target for this kind of weaponization by the state, and people who oppose transgenderism and the impacts of that on children, women, you know, LGB rights, free speech, all of those things are also a target. So I'm a double whammy target. And then you add on to that the fact that I've been extremely vocal. I've really embarrassed the local police with regards to their lack of political impartiality as a local councillor. I've built myself kind of a platform on the basis of that, in order to get that embarrassment as far and wide as possible to try and bring it to a halt. Because I feel like if councillors don't do that, if we're not brave enough to speak that, why are we even bothering to be councillors?
During the year, the party began to democratise, and all branch officials are now elected by the members. The members elected three people to the party board, and I was fortunate enough to be able to interview two out of the three who were successful.
And I think the key thing for me is, whilst we're polling really well now, and we're getting roughly what we're polling at is being, you know, translated into seats when we're allowed to vote. I think that come the general election, you know, my real world experience tells me that the legacy media, the establishment, the other parties, they're going to throw the kitchen sink at us, and they're going to use every trick in the book, whether it's fair means or foul, to stop us getting in. And so I think polling and passion is not going to be enough. We need to know what our voters are, and we need to know that they're still on board with us, because there's competitor parties starting now. And we need to know where the people are who might vote for us and what it would take to pull them onto the reform page. You know, what do we need to do? What do we need to kind of, how do we need to deal with them? And I think when we do that, when we've got that basic in place, we can get our vote out at the next election. And I think that's the key thing, because, you know, we can't emphasise strongly enough, if we don't win this next election or some sort of centre-right coalition, we'll end up with a rainbow left coalition, you know, whether it's Labour, Corbyn's party, the Lib Dems, you know, the Greens. And I think we'll be finished as a country. I think we'll be back in the EU. We'll be a rule taker on every level. That'll be it. And I think we've got one chance here.
One of the things I love about reform is that the people haven't had to elbow each other in the face for 20 years to get a seat. Mm-hmm. And so therefore there's this lack of cynicism. And that isn't naivety, which others may claim it to be. It is merely a lack of cynicism. It is a belief that we can achieve things. Whereas in the other parties, it goes, oh, well, I've always wanted a career in politics. 90% of our candidates didn't know they wanted a career in politics until about a week and a half ago. And I don't think they really want a career. They just want to do something for the country.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that lack of cynicism, that lack of belief. Now, maybe in 3-4 elections' time, it might be slightly, the mood might be slightly different in the party. But right now, it's not driven by anything other than a desire to basically get our country back.
Mm-hmm. So thanks to Dan Barker and to Gwen Towler, and I wish them well in their new roles. In September, I went to the party conference along with Nick Goulding, and we had a great couple of days.
Thank you.
sense the importance of it?
Oh, it's very important. I mean, this time last year I was here at conference and there was half the amount of people. The venue was half the size, but this year we've gone from having 80,000 members last year to 240,000 members. More people here, more stores, more events. And you know what? The feeling in this place as we go through today is going to be, it's going to be electric. And people are going to go away from this place feeling enthused, feeling like they want to get out there, knock on doors, campaign, become councillors. And in places like Wirral West, I tell you, we're coming for them.
So, Paul, what have you made of the conference so far?
It's a huge event. It's bigger, brighter, better, more optimistic than last year. And I think it proves that we're a party on the move, we're a professional outfit, and we're headed on an upward trajectory. But if we carry on in the way that we're moving at the moment, we'll be the next one in this country.
This conference is unbelievable. Were you here last year, Nick?
Yes.
Last year, you'll remember, it was about a quarter of the size. But the atmosphere is bullish here. We've got massive room here, which you can see behind me. Another one through a tunnel that way, about half a mile down the road. And what we have here is we have sponsors, we have the mainstream media, GB News, the forefront. But importantly, we've got a lot of lobbyists here. What lobbyists mean, Nick, you'll know as well as I do, you don't lobby people unless you believe that they're going to be able to do something for you in the future. And these lobbyists believe that Reform is going to form the next government, and that is why they're here. So very bullish. We're very excited.
I'm Abby Butcher, the campaign coordinator for Blackpool and Fleetwood Branch.
And Abby, what are your impressions of the conference so far?
I think it's been fantastic. I think 100 times better and more information being put across from the last conference. It's been more professionalised. I feel this time it's a lot more business related. So I think everyone's taking it a lot more serious.
And Abby, have you attended any fringe events at all?
I have. I've done a couple. I think they've been very informative. I think it's given people a completely different outlook on when they've got different areas that they want to touch base on. I think the crime stuff's been amazing. I know there's been so much going on, it's like you're sort of forgetting what you've been to because you've been to that much, but it's been fantastic.
For me, it feels a little bit like Glastonbury. You've got all these different stages going on. You've got the main stage and you've got the pyramid stage.
To be fair, it was like a dossier, the schedule, wasn't it? So it was. I did have to mark off what we was going to, but I do feel that they've pretty much covered everything.
Yeah. Have you got a message for the people of Blackpool?
You need to make sure you support the branch. Get out, get leaflet in, we need to take those seats.
When I was at the conference, I bumped into Mark Littlewood, formerly the Director General of the Institute of Economic Affairs. He very kindly agreed to come on the podcast and came on a couple of weeks later.
Yeah, the rough scale of what you're going to need in terms of personnel is one person to be Prime Minister, well, you seem to have that. At least 20 people who are capable of being cabinet ministers immediately on day one. I don't think you've got that 20 yet. An additional 330 people who are capable of being good parliamentarians from day one. I'm assuming, you know, 350 Reform MPs who are, you know, able to loyally support the government on the floor of the House of Commons, but are basically quite good at spreading the message, preferably quite good on the national media, could be the Reform backbench spokesman on any questions or Question Time or Newsnight or the Daily Politics or the World at One, etc., and know how to spread the local media message. You need 300 people of that ilk. You potentially need a further 500 if you're going to flood the House of Lords rather than reform the House of Lords. And in terms of the bureaucracy, you probably need, including senior civil servants, you know, who are difficult to shift, about 3,000 people who, you know, from, you know, advisors on flood defences to people who are experts on how the bus network across the UK works, to people who know which pesticides have been banned in farming and which haven't. 3,000. So, and you know, these people basically are all at one level or another need to be experts, you know, need to be highly talented. Not the MPs probably can be a bit generalist, but the chief advisor to the environment secretary on which pesticides can and can't be used in the UK. I mean, that's a pretty expert piece of policy knowledge, and you need about 3,000 such people. So You're right, there'll be some Labour and Conservative spads, you know, who will, having been issued their P45, will be interested in employment. But that's the sort of scale of personnel you're going to need to run a government. Yeah. And I think Reform are short in quite a substantial number of ways. There's time to make that up. But it's
there's a couple of years to go yet, isn't there? So we've got some time. Yeah. And that's always what I console myself with.
Yeah.
Could we just move maybe away from party politics a little bit? And because your expertise obviously is in economics, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I was a bit taken aback when we spoke briefly at the conference, and I said to you, can you tell me, Mark, which month of this year or next will the crash come?
Yeah.
And you said, I don't think there'll be a crash. I think it will just be a general deterioration of the state of things until such time as it just gets worse and worse. And that was very depressing to me.
Sorry about that. Economics is known as the dismal science, you know.
But I was looking, I had another look at the figures. And when you look at the figures and starkly, you know, with £3 trillion worth of debt, we have £112 billion worth of interest that we're paying each year on that debt. With gilts gone up in the last 3 years from 1% to 5.5% 30-year gilts, we're in a terrible state. We can't carry on. You know, you say it was just going to get worse and worse month after month. I can't see that can happen.
Well, you might be right. And, you know, it's the nature of, if you like, one-off apocalyptic economic inflection points is that they're rarely spotted in advance, right? There was virtually no one who said a week before the banking crash, guess what? There's going to be a banking crash. I think if anyone had answered your question by saying, well, actually, the answer is March the 16th, 2027. That is when the economic crash is going to happen. Take that with several buckets of salt, right? Because most economic forecasts are worthless, really. They're guesstimates. So I don't think there's... My point in my answer to you, Ken, at Reform Conference, was that I don't think I can put a particular month in which we suddenly run out of money. It doesn't quite happen that way. I mean, a number of things could occur, which I think would count as an economic crash. It could be that there's a run on sterling and sterling collapses and therefore inflation goes through the roof. And therefore interest rates have to go through the roof and therefore gilts will go through the roof. And you get a kind of perfect storm that makes plodding along in the rather unedifying fashion we are just impossible within 24 hours, that a massive change of direction needs to be had, that the government would need to, I don't know, sake of argument, suddenly cut public expenditure by 25% or something like that, just to balance the books. That's possible. That might be combined with calling in the IMF, for example, although I don't think the IMF now has the
money.
It doesn't have the resources to bail out Britain. So we're in many ways in a worse position than we were in the 1970s. I don't rule out that you could get something akin to the winter of discontent, that there's some sort of general strike, or when I say general strike, the public sector go on strike because the Labour government have to say, sorry, there's no more money for pay rises. And they say, well, we were hoping for 15 or 20%. So the country kind of grinds to a halt. I mean, oddly enough, in the short run, general strikes save you money because you don't need to pay wages. Obviously, they're very bad for economic growth. But what I expect to happen, my medium point prediction, it's with no certainties attached, is we will have 2 or 3 or 4 years of things getting marginally worse each year, that public services will continue to decay. The interest we have to pay on servicing our debt will continue to nudge up. Economic growth will be near as damn it zero, but we won't necessarily get a colossal recession. It will just plod along at 0.1%, 0.2% a year growth, nothing like enough to keep up with the debts and the liabilities that we're accruing. And yes, you know, there's an awful lot of ruin in a nation, as Adam Smith says, that you can actually continue along a pathway of doing unsustainable and stupid things for quite a long period of time. And sadly, my midpoint prediction is that's what will occur. I say sadly, I mean, it might be for the best of the country. Sometimes people want there to be a kind of day of destiny in which it's completely plain that things need to change because X has just happened.
some kind of a reset?
Yes, well, I mean, I think that you can have. I mean, I think a reset is coming, right? Because over the long run, our economic and fiscal position is unsustainable. And a feature of unsustainable positions is they're not sustained. They can't be sustained forever. It is impossible to sustain the present borrowing and expenditure by the UK government. It is impossible. We cannot raise enough tax to pay for all of the things that the government apparently wants to spend money on, let alone to begin to lower our liabilities. I mean, you've mentioned the $3 trillion and what we're doing on servicing the on-balance sheet debt. But we have accrued colossal liabilities that are not even on the balance sheet. Public sector pensions, for example. You know, we're going to have to some magic up some way of finding trillions of pounds if we're going to honour these, or are we going to dishonour them? Are we actually going to say to people in the public sector, well, you might have been planning on retiring next week, but bad news, your pension's only going to be half of what we told you it was. Colossal issues here. So a reset is coming. I just think it might happen in virtue of people getting sick to the back teeth with things gradually getting worse, with GDP per capita typically falling, with there being no evidence that Labour has a plan to in any way turn things round. They're based on the power of prayer. And that you get some reset because a new government says it can't be like this anymore. We're going to have to level with you about how bad the public finances are. And, you know, we're going to have to, I mean, I get sick and tired of politicians saying what difficult choices they take. They don't take any difficult choices at all. I mean, the real difficult choices in our in government spending is, you know, where are you going to find something like 100 to 200, maybe 250 billion pounds worth of savings? That's the sort of scale of savings that's required to make things sustainable. And not many people are willing to talk about that, other than sort of saying, oh, well, we're making a very difficult decision to, you know, save 300 million here or 300 million there. It's like worrying about, it's like having a 10 pound note behind your sofa and worrying that your house is burning down and you're going to lose the 10 pound note. You know, we're in a way, way worse position than. So all of these arguments about the triple lock pension, the winter fuel allowance, all of these sort of things, you can have an argument one way or another, but they are actually rounding errors within the overall fiscal situation that the UK finds itself in. And someone has got to find a way just to balance the books of reducing expenditure by 100 billion a year. That still involves us having a long-term unsustainable position, but at least it would balance things in the short or medium term. And I hope reform come up with some list like that.
The next podcast was with Philip Kisley of the New Culture Forum.
You know, we're talking about cultural relativism and the fact that we had to have all cultural aspects had. There's no ranking of them in terms of quality, that they're all the same. They all have equal value, and that's where we are. And it's hard to see where we go from there.
Yeah, it's a really difficult one, and the thing is, we have to be brave, and we really have to push back on it, and we have to re-establish standards, and we have to champion Western culture as the pinnacle of civilization. Essentially, I think that's what we have to do, because this stuff is really dangerous. Okay, but it's not just about the culture we make; it's about cultural practices as well. So, for example, female genital mutilation was unknown in this country until mass immigration. But people are squeamish about calling this out because they are frightened of criticizing other cultures. And again, it's the same kind of thing, Ken. We never used to have acid attacks, did we? Especially on women. We never used to have running machete fights in the streets. Again, these are, and the Pakistani rape gangs, again, is another example of this, where people are frightened to call this stuff out or to even criticize it because of cultural relativism, because we have it drummed into us that that all cultures are equal, and patently they are not equal, you know. And we are seeing the degrading of our society and the degrading of our culture, because if we stand up for it, there is a price to pay. Okay, so I was cancelled from my career in academia, 25 years in academia. I was essentially, because I did that, I stood up against Islamism. I said that trans women are men, you know, and all of that kind of thing. So there comes a time where we do have to be brave. And as we were saying before, there are more of us now. People are genuinely frightened. People are genuinely angry. Both of those things are really good. It does make people speak out. It does make people stand up. And we do have to celebrate Western culture. We have to celebrate this country. We have to be patriotic. We have to do all of those things that our parents, actually, it was the most natural thing in the world to do. We seem to have gone on this societal, political detour over the last 30 or 40 years, in which common sense and self-preservation have become, I don't know, you're a pariah if you practice any of those things. And we need to be in a situation, and thankfully we're getting back there, where enough of us are saying, look, no, actually, we are patriotic. We care about our country. We care about our children. We care about women. We care about safety. We care about our history. We don't want lies, and we are not comparable to primitive African history, heritage, and cultures. We are a different culture, and we must stand firm and celebrate that and shout it from the rooftops.
So this is a lie that's really been sold to the public. And so now you're starting to see this pivot from the Green Lobby, which is more along the lines of, yes, okay, maybe it's not so cheap after all, but the climate emergency means that we can't, there's no other option, we have to do it. Okay, well, that is a legitimate argument to make, but it's one that voters have to consent to. Voters have to agree to spend more money on energy in order to protect the climate. And, you know, so if that's what people want to do, then fine. But at the moment, the approach that's been taken is to impose that onto the public rather than to gain their consent for it. And it's been imposed alongside a lot of false and misleading and untrue information to try and sort of fudge this issue of consent. And so we need to be much more open and honest. And if the public wants to go along with it, then fine. I'm also not here to do the same thing and say, oh, well, this is in the best interest of people. I think people need to make their own choices about that. But it has to be done on the basis of correct information. So we've got this democratic deficit when it comes to net zero. And, you know, people say, oh, yeah, the polls show that the public's very supportive of environmental, responsibility and so on. And this is true, right? But then on the one hand, you say, well, how do you really expect people to say otherwise? You know, if a polling company comes up to you and says you care about the planet, you know, what sort of a psychopath is going to say no? So there's always that inherent bias there, where that people are unlikely to be genuinely truthful. But then when you follow up and say, well, how much are you willing to spend on these climate measures, they say something like £10 a year, some like ludicrously low amount of money that really wouldn't achieve anything. And I think that's where you see their true feelings about it, which is they're actually really not willing to make those sacrifices. So this issue of democratic consent is really important. And then I think the other factor here is that there's never been a debate around prevention versus adaptation. The assumption has been that we have to try to prevent climate change rather than that we should try and just adapt to climate change. And climate change is presented now as being something that's only caused by human activity, which is not correct. Climate change has happened ever since the Earth first had an atmosphere. The climate has been changing. And it's actually pretty difficult to unpick which elements of climate change would have happened anyway. But it is a fact that even if there were zero human beings on the planet and there'd been zero industrialization, there would still have been climate change. And if you look through human history, you've had migration of populations because of environmental factors. Floods and so on have required people to move from their one homeland to another. And somehow now in the modern age, we think we are somehow immune to that. And maybe that's an incorrect assumption. Maybe we should just say, yeah, some low-lying islands are going to flood. They would have flooded anyway. And the best thing to do is just simply to move the people somewhere else.
My fellow hosts, Wendy Whittaker-Large and Nick Goulding, had a very interesting podcast with Dr. David Starkey, the eminent historian and Conservative commentator.
So we were well received. There was no bitterness. There was something very different. There was a longing. There was a wanting. There was a sense which I've seen all over the country, felt all over the country, of something lost, of something needing in that word that I'm trying to push, restoration. So all of that. But there was also passion. There was serious questioning. People were keen to follow up. They were keen to ask practical questions. Many of them displayed significant political involvement and knowledge. So what I would say is, and I hope this isn't going to create too much disturbance in the Reform Party, it seems to me that the members are a good deal more impressive than the leadership. Am I allowed to say will this create ructions that will disturb, you know, the existing good humour of my relations with the party? The great doubt about reform is precisely its seriousness. That it's a mushroom creature. It sprung up overnight. Now, I think, again, I said this very clearly, I think there are fundamental reasons why it sprang up overnight. I mean, I am the first to admit, and indeed the whole of my argument what has happened in British politics over the course of the last 30 or 40 years is that the popular analysis of there being a uniparty is absolutely correct. We had a series of terrifying, I call it that slow burn French Revolution inflicted on Britain under Blair, which any proper Conservative government would have sought immediately to reverse. And instead, we had David Cameron, followed by Theresa May, followed by Boris Johnson, and with the only break being the very ineffective break of Liz Truss, explicitly continuing it, the famous remark of Cameron that he was heir to Blair. And of course, it's that successive process of a profound disillusionment it took. We need to remind ourselves, 14 years for the country to decide to get rid of the Conservative Party. It's taken them less than 12 months to decide that Labour is just as bad. And obviously, reform is the residuary legatee. It's all that's left.
The Together Declaration came out of COVID, and I was very pleased to welcome its founder, Alan Miller.
The British public are really very decent, and they were willing to and prepared, firstly, to volunteer. So nearly a million of them did that. That was poo-pooed and put to the sideline. And then, and I really respect this, right? Many people were like, look, take this seriously. They're stoic and like, be sensible. And I get that, right? Because it was like, who knew what was going on? And that manipulation and that derision towards people and that just kind of put stand in the corner, hands on heads and like do as you're told and constant fear, fear, fear and the science, repeating mantras is dangerous because what it does, not only is it wrong democratically and it treats people with contempt, you then set up a situation where people become very untrustworthy and cynical about things, about everything. And that is a problem as well. And it's just so wrong. Came right. It's just so wrong how they treated people. I mean, everything from the police following people, throwing snowballs, to saying you can't sit together in the park outdoors, like drones following the sign, like the whole litany of things that we've seen, and particularly, and we can come on to talk about this in the digital ID stuff. But what we saw in the lockdown files that came out with the Telegraph, and then the Twitter files when Elon bought X, and all the things. You know, the lockdown files, the spy units that were sent to citizens and doctors and journalists, and how the files were kept on people, and you know, everything from Mark Zuckerberg to conceding that, you know, Meta and Instagram and Facebook were all used to shadow ban and censor, and they were like being pressurized by the Biden administration and by the secret, you know, by the services, the internal services there. And all these things that you kind of think, oh, no, you know, if I came in and wrote a script and said this had happened, you'd think, don't be mad, right? That's over dramatic. That would never happen. Like that. All these things happened. They were done. And you're like, right, it was mad. It was, most of it was really completely unnecessarily, completely over the top, unacceptable. But the one thing I will say about it all is that through that treatment, which I would never, if I could stop it of happening, I would. But the thing that they, and this is as true for reform as I think for everything else. Now, obviously, reform have more history and going back, and obviously Brexit and what happened and didn't happen. But that government that was in power was only in power because of, you know, what happened before.
2019, we gave them that huge majority of seats.
Exactly. And they had a mandate and to go and do some things and to be effective and do it. And what did they do instead, right? It was insane and unacceptable. And that's why they've been so punished. And I'm not sure they're going to recover from that. And nor should they, in my opinion.
I don't know if YouTube are still shadow banning input with related to COVID, but I have to say that Alan's numbers were very disappointing for what was a very good podcast. So if you get the chance, go back and look at it again. So, the year that changed everything. Well, was it? Or was I talking about 2025? Perhaps I was talking about 2026. So if you'd like to join us for the next episode, we'll give our predictions for what will happen next year.